Okay, well, welcome to the first seminar at UNC. A little slow getting started this year, but we'll be better next term. I'd like to talk about some recent work that's been going on over a period of a year or more that I started with Karen Nappy and Ed Witten at Princeton. And at this point, Karen and I just wrote another paper that I've listed here. So there's a collection of information. I'm going to mainly focus on the newer results, although I'll try to remind you and review a little bit of the things that we did earlier to that. So this topic is about superconformal Yang-Mills theory in four dimensions. It's a gauge theory that's a brother of the ordinary gauge theory. And it has been found that at least at one loop in the Yang-Mills coupling constant, that there is some integrable structure in the sense that the anomalous dimension, that is the eigenvalue of the dilatation operator at one loop, can be found as the eigenvalues of a Hamiltonian that is a set of integrable Hamiltonians. So what I'd like to do today is to review a little bit about what it means to have an integrable Hamiltonian, even in a classical or quantum spin chain system, and to talk about the symmetries of that object and also this R matrix and beta Ansatz. And then I'll try to show you how these more conventional ideas of spin models fit into gauge theories, the particular n equal 4 superconformal gauge theory that we've been interested in to solve the anomalous dimension eigenvalues for. Some of the highlights of this calculation would be that this set of commuting Hamiltonians, it's really a hallmark and feature of the integrable systems. We can begin to identify what those commuting Hamiltonians are in the gauge theory, at least at one loop. And as you may remember, there is a set of special states in the gauge theory called the chiral primaries that have zero anomalous dimension. So that means that the Hamiltonian operator on those states is zero at one loop and at all loops. It will turn out that all of these Hamiltonians annihilate the chiral primaries. So we're beginning to see some of the structure of what this integrability is telling us about the spectrum of the full gauge theory. And then the last final comment that I'll talk about here is what happens above one loop. Is it integrable at all loops, and what can we say about that? So just for the moment, we're going to stick with regular integrable systems. And there is a model. It's not the Ising model exactly, but it's called the Heisenberg model. And you may have seen it before in the context of something called the XYZ model, which is a version of the Heisenberg model. The Heisenberg is called the XXX model, in which X, Y, and Z all have the same coupling. And what the XYZ model was a form of spins, SU2 spins in particular. And this A was running from 1 to 3. That means it's an element of SU2. And also, for XYZ, you would have had a different coupling constant for each A. So if you have XXX model, you just have the same coupling constant. So that gives you the SU2 symmetry. So the XXX Heisenberg model, or the Heisenberg model, the quantum version of the Heisenberg model, this is a quantum spin model because these are operators that they have commutation relations, is given by this Hamiltonian. It's a nearest neighbor Hamiltonian, like the Ising model is nearest neighbor. But there's three spins, not just one spin. And so the spin variables, the local spin variables, are the things that sit at each site on the chain of spins. So we have L sites here. And the local spin variables will satisfy this type of commutation relation. The symmetries of the whole system, if you will be the things that commute with the Hamiltonian. And what we call the total spin variable is just sum on the local spin variables. And if this satisfies that commutation relation, then this will satisfy this commutation relation. And furthermore, you can check that the total spin will commute with the Hamiltonian. So that's the SU2 symmetry of the Heisenberg model. Now, is there more symmetry? And the answer is yes. This history of the Yangian symmetry algebra was invented in 1985 by Drinfield. I had done some earlier work on Katz-Moody algebras in 1981, and it turns out that these Yangian algebras are related to the Katz-Moody algebras in the sense that the gauge orbits, the orbits of the two transformations are the same. So they have the same group structure, even though the algebras are different. But for the moment, let's just stick with the Drinfield Yangian generators. And they were discovered, the Yangian algebra is a Hopf algebra. It's not exactly a Lie algebra. It was discovered in the context of looking for solutions of something called the quantum Yang-Baxter equation that is relevant for these types of conventional spin models. And it was then, after 1985, it was shown by Denny Bernard that the Yangian really had something to do with the charge algebra of the principles of chiral models, the sigma models that people had originally found Katz-Moody algebras as the symmetry of the field transformations. So it's an interesting, for those of us who have lived through the history, it's a really interesting development of the historical ideas. So now what happens if we look at not the commutation of the ordinary symmetry generator with the Hamiltonian, but the Yangian generator with the Hamiltonian? Why is the thing shaking? I guess the scan transparency is one shape. So it turns out that if you take the generator, the commutation relation of the Hamiltonian with the first Yangian, so what are these Yangian generators? There's a whole set of them, like we have for Katz-Moody algebras. And we've just, for convenience, we would normally label them with an index n, but for convenience, we label the zeroth one as JA, the one that sits here, and J1 we will call QA. And J2 we will form by Q with QA with QB, will give a J2. We don't really need to talk about the higher charges too much. We can always get them, and they're there, and it's an infinite, Yangian is an infinite dimensional algebra, and it has representation theory, etc. But for the moment, we'll just stick with the first two generators. So what happens when we commute QA? It's funny because there's no noise with that shaking. Slight noise. What happens when we commute QA with H? We don't get zero exactly, but we get something that only contributes at the first point of the chain and the last point of the chain. So it's like a total derivative on a lattice. It's almost zero, but it's not strictly zero as long as you have non-periodic boundary conditions. Hi. We have a shaking screen today because of the noise outside. So this result, that QA with the Hamiltonian, was something that when Chiara and Ed Witten and I first wrote our paper the summer before last, we understood when we were looking up in the gauge theory the relevant Hamiltonian there, when we commuted with the Yangian generator there, we didn't get zero, and it was sort of a surprise to us. Now, since that time, I've learned more about integrable models. And so it turns out that if you look right in these conventional spin models, you will also see this edge effect that we found in the gauge theory the summer before that. And it's just reassuring, and you can understand it a little bit better here. So now, there'll be more about that commutation relation in a while. Now, what is the goal of having integrable methods? Why do you care that Hamiltonian that we wrote down here, this Hamiltonian, what does it mean to say it's an integrable Hamiltonian? I mean, it's good enough you have a Hamiltonian, you find its eigenvalues. You don't have to talk about what the rest of the structure is. Well, it will turn out that if it's a special type of Hamiltonian, what we really mean by integrable is they're not just one Hamiltonian, but there's a whole set of them, and they all commute with each other. it will turn out that if you have a Hamiltonian that belongs to such an integral family, that it is often easier to calculate the eigenspectrum of it. But what we really want to do is just calculate the eigenspectrum. So let's just see, for this model, let's just calculate the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of it, at least for L equal to 2, if you just have two sites. Then the vector space is spanned by these two vectors, and in fact you can, for two sites, the basis states will be these two-site or two-particle states, so it'll be four different possible states. The Hamiltonian I've just written here in gory detail in terms of the sigma matrix representation. This is like a tensor product between site 1 and site 2, and so these are each 2 by 2 matrices, and this becomes a 4 by 4 matrix. So what we're really asking in this simple example of two sites for this simple X Heisenberg Hamiltonian is that you want to find what the eigenvectors of this matrix are. So that's not a hard problem, and you can define a few more helpful objects like the permutation operator that exchanges site 1 and 2. And you can rewrite that as that. And then you can just solve for what the eigenstates are. So which linear combinations of those four basis states are actual eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian? And I've given them there. And the eigenvalues are 3 zeros and a 1. This is the coupling constant. Now, this is just a spin model. It has nothing to do with relativistic gauge theories. But it will turn out that if you look in the full gauge theory, which is going to be a D equal 4 theory, it will have N equal 4 supersymmetry. It will have an SUN gauge group. And it will be considered in the limit that N goes to infinity. This is the Etchoff limit. Now, if we look at what the symmetry of this theory is, which I will go over on a slide, but let me just remind you in order to make a point about what we're talking about now. What we've done so far here is just SU2 symmetry, whereas the symmetry that is going to be relevant for this thing is a much larger symmetry. It has a bosonic piece, which is SO2, 4 plus SU4. That's the R symmetry and the conformal group in four dimensions, plus the 32 supercharges. So this is what plays the role, takes the place of what would be the Poincaré group in ordinary Yang-Mills theory. Now we have a much larger symmetry group here. And this whole thing is called the superalgebra PSU 224. But this superalgebra has, if you look in here, there will be an SU2 subgroup. There will also be one in here, but let's look in here. And what Minahan and Zarembo did before they talked about SO6 was that they actually just looked at an SU2 subgroup that sat in this SU4. And they noticed that all the states in this system, which are going to be eigenstates of the Hamiltonian operator, if we do radial quantization of this, the dilatation is the Hamiltonian. If they notice that for the SU2 subgroup of this, that the anomalous dimensions of all the states at one loop in this theory were given exactly by these types of eigenvalues. Here we just have L equal 2, but if you did L equal 3 and diagonalize the Hamiltonian, you get other anomalous dimension eigenvalues. So they showed that one loop, the structure that sits in this gauge theory, has something to do with an integrable Heisenberg Hamiltonian. L is the number, so if we have a state in the system, let's call it O, and for radial quantization you can get to that by looking at some operator acting on the vacuum. And this thing will have L, so you have everything but an eraser. That's all right, I'll just work here. And what is O of X? It's a local operator. And remember, for N equal 4, the gluon multiplet, the super multiplet. That is to say, all the massless fields in the theory are the gauge, the four fermions, which are also in the adjuvant, and the six scalars, which are also in the adjuvant. And so each of these fields, and you can also take derivatives of these fields, you can make letters, and so you have the derivative of, let's say, you take gauge invariant combinations. And you might also want to multiply the whole thing up by an SUN matrix, so that these things are A mu ij or phi. So this operator O of x is B mu F mu sigma. There's an ij. Then you take another one, like phi I, jk, and you come rolling along like this. These are called letters. This is called a local operator that makes a word. These are all at the same space-time point. That's why it's local. But however many entries you have here, that's the number of, that's what L is. So you can consider different states in the superconformal theory. You can consider a state, what we call a two-particle state, and that would have L equal 2. If you had an infinite particle state, then you'd have L equal infinity. But in general, you want L to be different things. Yeah, it will turn out, if L is finite, then there will only be a finite number of Yangian generators, namely L minus 1. Separately. And I find it rather remarkable that to calculate the one loop contribution to the anomalous dimension of such a state, if you just restrict yourself to SU2, so you'd only have, you wouldn't have any of these types of guys. If you had SU2, you'd only have two of these scalars, effectively. You'd have phi 1 plus I phi 2, which we could call W, and phi 1 plus phi 3 plus I phi 4, which we could call Z. So you would only make words O of X, which would be W, W, Z, W. And then if you want it to be gauge invariant, you take a trace. That's called a single trace. If you had a double trace, you'd have one of these, and then you'd have another trace. And if you're doing large N, it turns out that the states that survive are one-to-one correspondence with a single trace operator. So I find it rather remarkable that if you take just this combination and then do the Feynman graph at one loop to get what the anomalous dimension is, and you look at the number, the eigenvalue of the anomalous dimension operator, you will start seeing these numbers. I mean, here you just get zeros, but you will, in fact, find zero for those three states. And those three states are, this is the trace of two Z's, this is the trace of ZW, etc. If you get a little more adventuresome, you can look at four, L equals four states, and that will have this anomalous dimension. So this is an unprotected state. And now, the thing that really got this off the ground was originally people had looked at chiral primary states. Now, chiral primary states have H equal to zero. They're examples that may be like the top three. What really got this whole business off the ground, as far as really getting your hands on the spectrum of the gauge theory, was the work of Maldacena, Berenstein, and Nastasi, because they understood that there were another set of states in the theory that were not chiral primaries. They didn't have zero anomalous dimension. But you could easily get what their anomalous dimension was. And so the fact that there were states that could be accessible and you could work out the Feynman graphs in a fairly coherent fashion really gave a boost to the whole program of of Minahan and Zaremba looking for the eigenvalues. Now let's go back to the algebra again, just because that's the thing that we were focusing on in our last paper. It's looking like a Katz-Moody algebra in the sense that there is a finite dimensional subgroup. And so the Yangian, you say whatever G is, so this line is closing the commutation relations of G, a finite dimensional semi-simple Lie algebra, let's say. And then for any G, you can build this structure, the Y of G, which we call the Yangian. And the commutation of J with Q will be Q, but if you take the commutator of three of these things, if it were strictly a Katz-Moody algebra, the right-hand side here would be zero. Now, this is not the Jacobi identity, because you have J and Q. It's not all the same element up here. So you can still have an algebra, algebra that has commutation relations, but an algebra that satisfies the Jacobi identity. So the Yangian is satisfying the Jacobi identity. It's just that it's not satisfying so the Katz-Moody algebra would say that Jn with Jm is FABC. Jn plus MC. So that would say that, for example, Ja with QB, so that's J naught with J1, JA with QB, would be FABC Q1. So this is JQ. So if this is a 0 and this is a 1, this has to be a 1. And that's a Q and that's a Q. So that commutation works, but then if you did J2 with J2, J1 with J1, you would get J2. Now, if you do Q with Q, QA with QB, you get FABC times something that we could call J2. But then you get another piece, which looks like F, two Fs and a bunch of Js, ordinary Js, C, D, E. So we have these three Fs. There's some set of structure constants who absorb these three indices. So this commutation relation, when this is a Yangian generator, this will not just be the Katz-Moody term, but it will have an extra piece like this. And often they write the relationship like this. This is called a Serre relation, because this is just in terms of the first two generators. Now, so that's the algebra that we're going with. That's the thing that is appearing in these spin models. It's the thing that's appearing in the gauge theory. It's the thing that appears in the ADS-CFT dual of the gauge theory when you have type DB strings on ADS-5 plus S5 that Polchinski, Dana, and Roydan found. So that's the algebra that we want to think about, the Yangian algebra. And the commutation relation is satisfied by particular representations of the algebra. And so this was what the representation that we looked at. The zero term was just JA. And this first term we gave a particular, so JA was given in terms of the sum of the local spin variables. The first non-local charge was given in terms of this bilocal sum. Now it will turn out that this, and this are only satisfying the Yangian commutation relations. Not for any representation J, but only when J is in a particular, only when this is in a particular kind of representation. And in particular, if this is this, the local spin variable is this, then it will satisfy. And so what that criterion is, and that's the thing that we worked out in that second paper. It was really a conference proceedings, but there was a lot of new technical work in that paper. What we understood was that the representations that will close this Yang-Yang in algebra are given by that bilocal form of the Q's, but the single site operator J has to be in a particular representation of the group. And that representation is such that R is such that R across R bar contains the adjoint only once. So if you think about what is, so here we have QA FAB C I J I B J J C. J A is the sum on I. Now what we're saying is that J I A has to be in a representation R of, let's say, SU2, since this is what we're doing, such that R cross R bar contains the adjoint only once. And if you think of the 2, or the N of SUN, N cross N bar always contains the adjoint only once. If the adjoint of SU2, then that wouldn't necessarily, I mean, you can think about it, but it's not always true. But it will be true if you have the fundamental representation. All right, so this was the understanding of the algebra and how the kinds of representations that we're going to be using in the gauge theory are closing the commutation relations. So the Yang-Yang is a Hopf algebra. It has a natural way of defining tensor products of representations through its coproduct. I'm not going to talk about that too much, although I did put some notes up on the Princeton server for the school last summer, and there's a pretty nice discussion in those notes of the coproduct and how to construct the representations of the Yang-Yang. So if you have more than for the higher generators. This is the history that I talked about before. And now the question is, how does this knowledge of the algebra actually help us define the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian? If we only had L equal to 2 sites, then we could just diagonalize the Hamiltonian directly. But if we have an arbitrary number of sites, it gets much harder to do it. So here's the concept of what it means for a Hamiltonian to be integrable. It won't just be the one Hamiltonian that we talked about so far, but there will be a set of them. And in fact, the second one in this Heisenberg model example will be something like that. So this will commute with that, and each of these things will commute with the symmetry generators. Now, one of the statements that we make when we talk about the theory is that in some sense the set of abelian Hamiltonians or commuting Hamiltonians are like Casimirs of the Yang-Yang. Certainly they're Casimirs of the ordinary symmetry SU2 because they all commute exactly with SU2. They almost commute with QA up to those edge effects. And so at the moment we're just calling them Casimirs of the Yang-Yang. And we'll get a little bit more specific about that as we go on. So the procedure for finding the eigenvectors and eigenvalues of this Hamiltonian is an old procedure. It's been developed by the Leningrad School, by Fadeyev and his collaborators. In particular, there was a very nice piece of work by Reshetykin and some of his collaborators, where they understood very specific calculations for this SU2 model. The way it happens is that once you have the Hamiltonian, you can begin to think of building a more general structure that that you can then get all the Hamiltonians, the set of integrable Hamiltonians from. And one of the ingredients of this method is something called the universal R matrix. This is the Yang-Baxter equation. And there will be a structure, an R matrix, that I'll talk about on the next slide. And it will have some type of relation. If you look at this, this is 3, 2, 3, 1. And here it's 3, 1, 3, 2. So this is like AB and this is BA. So what this Yang-Baxter relation is doing is in some sense telling you how the R matrix doesn't quite commute with itself. It almost commutes, but it needs to have this extra term on the ends. And it's really the algebra of this Yang-Baxter relation is what's related to this encoding the Yangian algebra. So I'll try to make that more explicit as we go on. So the Hamiltonian that we started with can be derived in terms of an R matrix. And then once you have that R matrix, then you can get the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian by looking at the properties of products of the R matrices. So if we have an algebra, for our example, it's going to be Y of SU2, the Yangian of SU2. The R matrix is an element of A cross A. The Yang-Baxter relation that I wrote down before holds in A cross A cross A. And whatever this universal R matrix is, these representations on two sites are given in forms like this. These formulas can all be made rather precise. I'm just trying to give you a general idea here of what's happening. So in particular, an R matrix looks like this object. This mu is called a spectral parameter. If you evaluate it at U equal to zero, you get back to this permutation operator that we defined a couple of slides ago. And so in this representation of the R matrix, which is called evaluation representations of the Yangian, this representation of the R matrix, you can show that abstract equation that I had on the previous slide becomes such an equation. And again, what it's telling us is how U and V and commutes to V and U, but not quite with these, you need these extra terms. So there is a way to find, once you have an understanding of what the representations of the Yangian are, there's a way to find this form that we've given here in order to have it close such a Yang-Baxter relation. So I've just written this in sort of abstract form here of how you get from the specific representation back to the universal R matrix. So how does it go? You take the R matrix. You can either work with the R matrix directly, or sometimes it's useful just for cosmetic purposes to shift it by, and then they call this the lax operator. You can do it either way. It's just that the equations come out more symmetric at the end if you do the shift now. You then define a product of these R matrices, or these lax operators, with one common site, which is called an auxiliary site M, and then L sites on the lattice, L quantum sites. Now that product is telling you really how to move from 1 up to L. It's like a transport. And this monodromy is sometimes called holonomy. It's a certain kind of holonomy. So whatever it is, you can, if you have a specific representation for the lax operators, you can actually calculate what that matrix is. It'll come out in terms of this M parameter. Remember, M was labeling, for example, the Pauli matrix on the previous slide. So here was the R's, where the M matrix was either identity matrix or a Pauli matrix. So this is a 2x2 structure. So this, at the end, as far as the matrix living on the auxiliary site, it's a 2x2 structure, and each of these has the quantum variables J1 through JL. You can also expand this monodromy once you've taken the product in the spectral parameter, and you'll begin to see the Yang-Yin generators appearing. So clearly the monodromy is encoding the Yang-Yin symmetry. Now, one of the comments about the monodromy that was made more in the classical systems than in these quantum systems that we're talking about here was that the monodromy had a feature that if you expanded it around U, as we're doing here, you would get the non-local charges. These are the Yang-Yin generators. If you expanded it around U inverse and looked at periodic boundary conditions, you would then find local commuting Hamiltonians. Now, in the quantum case, it works similarly, but in a slightly different fashion because you have to be careful of ordering of the quantum variables. It will turn out that you can expand the monodromy to get the non-local generators, QA, and the higher Yang-Yin generators in this fashion. If you take the trace of this matrix, so you just take A plus B, and then take the derivative of the log of the trace, you will find the Hamiltonian. And remember, there's a family of Hamiltonians. So to get the nth Hamiltonian, you take the nth derivative of the log of the trace. It's a little bit like in Feynman graphs. If you have the connected versus disconnected graphs, to get the connected graphs, you'd have to take the log of Z. And that was really understood. This feature of how to get back to the abelian Hamiltonians from the monodromy was understood by Luscher. It wasn't really understood by the integrable systems people. All right, so there's a Yang-Baxter for the R matrix itself. There's also a Yang-Baxter relation that has one R matrix and two of these monodromy matrices in it. From this, you can see that if you trace on M to get P, that since this is only involving the auxiliary sites, if you trace on each of the auxiliary sites, then you have U with V is V with U. So this is a commuting set. The traces do commute. And that's really why you can then find an infinite set of Hamiltonians, because you can take the nth derivative here and the mth derivative here, and those two Hamiltonians will commute with each other. And furthermore, not only do you get a set of commuting Hamiltonians out of this, but you also, from this scattering data, which sits here up in the monodromy, you can begin to identify relations between these different things, because remember, this T has to satisfy this Yang-Baxter relation. And those relations, then there is a prescription about how to form what the form of the eigenvector of the Hamiltonian in terms of A, B, C, and D. And that's really what Minahan and Zarembo used then. So now I just want to give you just a little bit more detail, and then we'll move on to the gauge theory. There is a slightly more interesting version of the conventional spin models than the one that I'm talking about so far. What I've been talking about so far was the XXX model in the spin 1/2 representation. So those local spin variables were satisfying JAI was a Pauli matrix. On some site, J was a Pauli matrix. Now, you could have considered the Heisenberg model with an arbitrary representation here. It's still an SU2 generator, but it would be living in a 2s plus 1 dimensional Hilbert space, not just a 2 dimensional Hilbert space. And what Reshetikin did was he understood not just how to integrate the XXX half model, but also how to integrate the XXX spin S model. And it will turn out that these formulas, even though it's still an SU2 subgroup, these are the formulas that will lift directly into not just an SU2 subsector of PSU224, but the entire PSU224 gauge thing. So let me just roll this by you slide, the next two slides pretty quickly because it's a lot of detail and you should just try to get the gist of it. What we're trying to do is calculate, if we know that this is the R matrix on an auxiliary site and a quantum site, then this will be in spin S. This will still be in the Pauli representation. But what we'd like to now do is find Rij, because we have Rij, Rim, Rjm. Now Rij will be two spin S representations. And you might think, well, I'll just put a spin S representation there and another spin S representation there. That turns out not to work. And so what you need to do is write this Yang-Baxter equation, which I've written out in gory detail here, is RRR is equal to these two R's in reverse order times the R. And you use this as a linear equation for Rij. This is the unknown variable now, the unknown function. So in particular, if you let go to this set of choice of the indices, then all this stuff begins to simplify a little bit. You can begin to see if you've got a sigma here, if you've got a J here and another J here, that things are going to... things are going to combine into products of the J's, and in fact at the end of the day you'll be able to show that the kinds of combinations that you get here on the lattice sites are the generators QA and then some of the J's on individual sites. And there's a total J. And there's J's on individual sites again. So this is just an identity to go from here to here. Now remember, what we're trying to do is solve for this R matrix that has two spin S's in it. So it will turn out to be useful to use certain properties of SG2. One is that the quadratic Casimir can be written as J times J plus 1. I have a minus sign because of the conventions. This is also true for any site Casimir. One particle is two particles, but particularly we'll look at it for the two particle site. So we use this feature. We also use the feature that if we have two representations, two single particle representations, so these are each eigenvectors or modules of the single spin operator. If you want to get a module of the two particle operators, that you take this tensor product and it will decompose into this form. This is a feature of SU2 representation. So now, if you continue on with the equation that we had on the previous page, if you now assume, you can also rewrite this in a slightly more symmetric form because we know that we've assumed that R12, whatever it is going to be only a function of that quadratic Casimir. Now, it'll turn out that you make that assumption and then it works. You can find such an answer, so that will be good enough. So once you've done that, then you can write this equation in a slightly more symmetric form. You add it, you add J2 here. So you have J1 plus J2, which will commute with R. So then you have another equation for minus J2. So here it is in fairly symmetric form. And this object J1 minus J2 is what we were calling QA before. That was the thing that was sitting on the right-hand side of the commutator of H with the Yangian generator. So it's like a difference operator, QA. So the Yang-Baxter equation has been reduced to this form, which if we now make a further ansatz that it has this functional dependence on the quadratic Casimir, the two-site quadratic Casimir, plus this permutation operator, which will just switch a few signs around, then this equation becomes this equation. And now we've gotten rid of the ordering because of this permutation. And so we can now just tell you the answer to what Rj has to be, which I'm giving to you here. The way you can do this, Yushitikin and Fadeyev had a rather convoluted or it was extremely elegant, but it was very specific to SU2. You can also make all of these arguments now once you've rewritten it in terms of the Yangian generally, which they did not do. They used other properties of the system. But having displayed this Yangian generator as the coefficients of the R matrix, in the equation for the R matrix, you can then use these identities and use the fact that as you operate with this difference operator on an eigenvalue of the quadratic Casimir, it'll only move it it'll only move it to a state with one less eigenvalue or one greater eigenvalue. It won't move it arbitrarily far. You can prove that in SU2. This is the procedure that we did a summer before last in our original paper in the full gauge theory directly. So you can do that also for PSU224. But in any case, the answer will turn out to give the equation for R, which is related to the R matrix that we're looking for, and it will have this form. Just two gamma matrices over each other. And then if you go back to find what is the abelian Hamiltonian, you get it by taking the derivative of the log of this trace of R. So you form the monodromy from these R's by taking a product, R1M, R2M, R3M. Take the trace of that, and then take the derivative of the log of that trace, and what you will find is that the Hamiltonian, it really then just becomes the derivative of the log of each of them. And if you remember that the derivative of the log of the Euler gamma function is this di gamma function psi of x, so that's what, well, for the spin S model, the Hamiltonian isn't written as, so this was written as JIA, JI plus 1A, plus some constant. For the XXXS model, where these are in the spin S representation, this is in spin 1/2, spin S representation, it's going to be written as 2 minus 2 psi, so sum on I, 2 minus 2 psi of JII plus 1, something like that. And JI times I plus 1 is JI plus JI plus 1 AA squared, the quadratic Casimir on any two sites. That's J times JI plus 1. J, I plus 1. Okay. J plus 1 times J is equal to the quadratic Casimir. So it turns out that for this still rather conventional spin model, but now the spins are in the spin S representation, you don't just put this same form in the Hamiltonian where these are two S plus 1 dimensional matrices, but you have to put this whole new function here. If you want it to be an integrable Hamiltonian, if you want it to have brothers that will commute with it, etc. And so, if you want to go back and check that that formula reduces to the nearest neighbor form that you're used to when you have a spin 1/2 representation, then you can use something called the method of Lagrange polynomials, interpolating polynomials, which I won't really discuss here. But you can take any function, and you want that function to be equal to a polynomial in some thing. So this is J, let's just do J1, J2. Then you get J1 squared, which is just S times S plus 1, J2 squared, which is again some C number, but then you get J1, J2. That's the non-trivial operator that's related to the quadratic Casimir. So if you want to write this thing as a polynomial in this form that you're used to seeing up here, J1, J2, then you can look at where the eigenvalues, the value of this function, the eigenvalues of that operator, and equate it using this method of interpolating polynomial. So when you do all of that, this function can be rewritten as this polynomial. If S is a half, the polynomial is just given by this, is given in this equation. The polynomial is given by this form for a particular value, S equal to a half. So this is just reproducing this. And if you have S equal to 1, then you get two terms here. So for S equal to 1, a spin 1 Heisenberg Hamiltonian, the Hamiltonian won't just be the nearest neighbor site, but it will also have this extra term. So this is the integrable Hamiltonian for spin 1. SU2. This is SU2. All right, now let's go to the gauge theory. So we talked about how this integrable structure is fitting into the gauge theory. We believe it to be true for the planar limit. We don't believe it to be true if you're not at large n. If you were not at large n, if you're an ordinary gauge theory, not in the planar limit, then presumably you would begin to see selection rules in the data that comes out. And so since you're not seeing selection rules due to some higher Yangian symmetry, it means that that Yangian symmetry is really something that's just probably is just going to happen at the large n limit. It's probably too much to hope for that it will occur for finite values of n. This is the algebra. This is the radial quantization of the theory. This is the Hamiltonian, the dilatation, which is congruent to p naught plus k naught. You may have seen that the Hamiltonian for this system is p naught plus k naught if you read in the Aharoni, Oz, etc. review article. But this dilatation is equal to u times that operator times u inverse. So you can either use the dilatation or that. And we will use the dilatation as the Hamiltonian. And here's the one-to-one correspondence with the states, and here's the set of letters and words that we talked about earlier. So this fact that we've got L sites here is really coming from the fact that we've taken the large N limit. And so that the fact that even though it's a four-dimensional gauge theory, because we've taken this planar limit, we've somehow unearthed this one-dimensional structure of just a chain of things coming along here. And that's probably the secret of why the thing is integrable at the large limit. So again, we can try to get our hands on some of this integrable structure. Now in the full gauge theory, we have this commutation relation for the local spin variables, where now these are the full PSU224 structure constant. Two-particle Casimir will turn out for PSU224 as though the group were SU2. If you're on the two-site system, it will turn out that the quadratic Casimir can again be talked about just as J times J plus 1. Now, that was a result that Beissert had in his original paper using something called polya theory. And then we proved it in our first paper in the appendix using the physical arguments. SU2, it's always true that J times J, the quadratic, is J times J plus 1. But for PSU224, it's only true if you're on two sites. So a lot of things are coming together in this gauge theory that are making it possible to impose some of these integral methods. Again, another feature that happens is that if you take the single particle module, so the single particle module is the thing that's made out of one of these guys. So either this guy or this guy. We have L equal to one letter. Then the space of those states is called VF. And if we want to have two letters, because that's what we're acting on here, we have two sites all the time, these R matrices, then we would consider the tensor product of two of these single letter spaces of single letters. And it will again turn out that they will have this remarkably simple tensor decomposition, where J doesn't run from 0 to 2s like it did in the spin S XXX model, but it runs from 0 to infinity. But nonetheless, these are irreducible representations of PSU224. And you can look at their highest weight, and you can see how each of them has a whole set of states. So now we make an R matrix where we don't use the representation of SU2 anymore, but we're going to use the representation of PSU224. In fact, we use a representation of U44 because it's simpler, and then we'll go back to PSU224. This is a slightly larger group. It has two more U1 generators than PSU224 does. We also use this representation. Remember before, when we did the spin S case, we had the spin S representation here and the Pauli matrix here. Now we have the quantum representation of one particle states here, and we have the U44 matrix representation there. The 4-4 representation of U44. And now we know what this is, so it occurs there and there and there and there, and now we're going to solve this equation for Rij, and it comes out to be this form, using all of those Yang-Mi methods that we had before. But it's the same form. Two gamma matrices on top of each other. Now, that was a two-site R matrix. If you want to look at how that acts on the states of VF cross VF was equal to a sum on VJ, all those irreducible representations, then you let that state act minus 1 to the J, that's the permutation operator. Remember, we had Rij with little r times P12. So P12 acts as this in that fashion, which you can check by looking at how the states of PSU224 act, how they look. And then you can write this generator in this fashion, and if you want to let it act on any state, this is acting on the two particle states, it's acting on VF cross VF. VF cross VF was a direct sum of VJs. So if you want to see how this is acting on the direct sum of VJs, it acts like this. So this projects now from the sites at 1 and 2 onto the site VJ, onto the module VJ. This is a projection operator, whereas this is a permutation. This is different. So again, you can make the transfer matrix by taking, the transfer matrix is the trace of the monodromy. You can make that by taking the trace of the product of the R's. You take the derivative and you find that the Hamiltonian is given by this form. Now, this is not Heisenberg model anymore. This is PSU224. It turns out that this is the form of the Hamiltonian that Beissert originally wrote down by doing one-loop Feynman graphs in the full gauge theory. And also this R matrix, and several papers later, Beissert and Staudacker had a slightly different version of the R matrix, a different formulation of it. It turns out to be equal to this formulation by using reflection formulas for the Euler gamma functions. But they got it not by looking at this system of equations that we did, but by looking at what it looked like in some subsector, some SL2 subsector, which was a non-compact version of the SU2 subsector. And they lifted from SL2 up to the full theory using uniqueness arguments. And so we're, in a sense, pleased that the answers came out to be the same. It's putting a little more structure into the whole way of understanding things. All right, now the last couple of slides here, I just want to tell you a few more features. So far we've stacked up the R matrix fairly well. We've stacked up the Hamiltonians fairly well, at least the first Hamiltonian. Now, what we'd like to do is talk a little bit more about the higher set of Hamiltonians. So we're claiming that it's the kth derivative of the log of the trace of the monodromy matrix, which I've tried to write here. Now, it will turn out that because we're doing gauge theories and because we want to have gauge invariant states, that in particular, people are interested in having, so we had this operator, O of X, was a single trace of things like Fu nu, Fi. And the fact that we've traced there is some evidence that this site and this, the site at the end, what do we call it? This site at the end can be switched around, it can be identified with each other. And it will turn out that in order to get the eigenvalues from the spin models to be equal to the eigenvalues of the anomalous dimension, that you need to impose periodic boundary conditions on the spin model. Now, if you remember, we had things like QA with H was J1 minus JL plus 1. So you might say, well, great, you pose periodic boundary conditions, J1 is JL plus 1, you get a 0 over here, and you've got an exact symmetry in that case. Now, the only hitch with that is that if you look carefully at our representation for the Yangian generator, the non-local Yangian generator, that since it's defined that I is always less than J, if you try to set J1 equal to JL plus 1, you can't define this particular representation anymore. So that led to a certain amount of grumbling in the community that, well, the Yangian structure was there, it was interesting, but it didn't have anything to do with the gauge theory, because the gauge theory needed periodic boundary conditions. But of course, you know that it has something to do with the gauge theory, because the monodromy is really carrying that information, and the monodromy doesn't care about periodic boundary conditions because it's only defined on L sites. It's not defined on L plus 1 sites. So all of the analyticity properties of the monodromy are encoded in the Yangian symmetry, even though you can't define the Yangian symmetry for periodic boundary conditions. But we thought we'd like to make a few statements anyway of what can you do for objects that have periodic boundary conditions. So you can't define Q, but you can certainly define these H's. And how do you do that? The H's were supposed to have this type of property with the Q's. So in that sense, we're saying that if you take the commutator, and the way you would get this is you would consider some open chain H here. You don't impose periodic boundary conditions. That's how we found this edge effect in the first place. If after you do this calculation, this is for open chain, this is for open chain, this is for open chain, after you do the calculation, if you then set J1 equal J plus 1, the right-hand side vanishes. And there is a way to go back and dig in here and see how to define what H periodic is from this object. And so that's really the method. You might say, well, you can always get the periodic Hamiltonians by just taking the derivative of the log of the transfer matrix once you have it. But it turns out that this procedure of taking these derivatives gets more and more complicated as you get to these bigger groups, because you don't have the nice properties of the projection operators that you had in SU2 anymore. And so it's hard to really take these derivatives if you have more than one derivative there. Whereas our procedure will be to just look for Casimirs of the Yangian. And that we're fairly successful at. So one of our new results, I mean, there's been several new results here, but one that I'm talking about now, is that we were able to write down what the second Hamiltonian looks like for the full gauge theory. Here's the first Hamiltonian in terms of this digamma function. And here's the second Hamiltonian, a product of the digamma function. So the way it works is that if you look at H bar with QA, we said that's this calculation we just talked about. It would be this edge effect, which I'm calling Q1. L plus 1. I'm just relabeling that by that notation. It will turn out that U bar with QA, so H bar with QA is an edge effect. U bar with QA, which is U bar would be an open chain version of this object, U bar with QA will go like that. So again, if you set J1 equal to JL plus 1, the right hand side will vanish. Yes. Yeah, but those are formulas for the momentum, not for the symmetry generators.
I understand.
Right. So probably it's just a coincidence, but yes, the thought had crossed one's mind. So here are the representations that we want to use for QA and JA as before, and then I've just repeating here that you can get some Casimir structure if you take periodic boundary conditions. Now, once we've got this generator, U bar, and I might add that people had understood what this object was for the SU2 subsector. But there it's a little easier to calculate. So the contribution here is that this is the expression for the PSU2 force theory, and this will in fact reduce to the previously known expression for SU2. So once we have it, we'd now like to know what we might do with it. And here's the statement that they will annihilate the chiral primary states. So all of these Hamilton, and we're conjecturing that not just U, the second one, H2 we called U because we didn't know a lot of indices flying around, but we're conjecturing that all of the commuting Hamiltonians will annihilate the chiral primaries. So here is the chiral primaries. Remember, these are the generators, some of the generators in PSU224. There's the special conformal transformations. There's some of the supercharges. So the primaries, the conformal primaries, if you don't think about chiral primaries, the conformal primaries are annihilated by these generators. There's a slightly even more special set of states called the chiral primaries that are annihilated by all of these generators plus half of the other set of supercharges. And those are the states that, if you remember, in the ADS-CFT dual theory, the supergravity states are related to these chiral primaries, the ones that Witten first worked out in the holographic theory. So what are the chiral primaries? Well, again, there'll be some, each one will be a module. It will have a highest weight. And what that highest weight is if you have two sites, it's always given in terms of the scalar fields. And remember, there's a lot of fields here. There's scalar fields, there's spinner fields, there's vector fields. But the chiral primaries will always be given in terms of these scalar fields. And furthermore, there will be symmetric traceless products of those things. So if you have two sites, it'll be given by this form. If you have three sites, it's you symmetrize in ij and k and subtract the traces, et cetera. Traceless, if you have more than two sites, traceless means in any two indices. So you can just take the formula for H1 and H2, we call them H and U, and act on the chiral primaries. Now we expect H to annihilate the chiral primary because we know that the chiral primary is the protected state. It's the one that doesn't get anomalous dimension corrections. So here's how H acts on a site with L chiral primary with L sites. It acts, H, remember, is 2 times the digamma function. The digamma function we've written, we've encoded it into this little H function. It will turn out that H can be written as the harmonic numbers if these are integer, if these eigenvalues are integer. So it will turn out that H of 0 is 0. We can just check that. You can see it right from here. If you set J equal 0, then psi 1 minus psi 1 is 0. So H is going to be of this form. It's given by this sum over nearest neighbor sites. And if you project it onto the complete set of, it acts two sites at a time. So if you project this onto the tensor product of 2 VFs, then it will be this of this form. This is how it acts on the tensor product of 2 VFs. How it acts on one of those, remember 2 VFs was VF times VF was equal to the direct sum of J equals 0 to infinity V sub J. So if you want H12 or HI, I plus 1 to act on this thing, it has to act on these J's. And there's a sum here from 0 to infinity. So that's the sum from 0 to infinity. And it projects from, if you're on site 1 and site 2, it projects onto VJ, that J. Now, it will turn out that of all of the stuff that contributes in the sum, all these J's, that only the J equal to 0 term is going to survive. These, if you look at projections onto the higher modules, it will be 0. You can do that, you can check that by hand for the first few states. Sites, number of sites if you want. You can also just think about how the chiral primary is defined. It's symmetric and traceless in all the indices, so it will be symmetric and traceless in any pair of indices. And if you're looking at a pair of indices, the pair is going to have only scalar fields in it. So if you look at the list of what the highest weights are of all of these modules, and you can classify all these and see what the highest weights for each J looks like, then only j equals 0 will have symmetric traceless combinations of the scalars. If you have the spinner fields, they'll be in some higher j. So you have to know that, you have to check that, but you can find that and see. So this was just verifying that the Hamiltonian, the anomalous, the one loop anomalous dimension of the chiral primary was 0, which we knew already. Now we'd like to look at how the Hamiltonian works on the, how the U works on it. This is the second Hamiltonian on the chiral primary. Now that's just, was a commutator of two of those digamma functions, which we can rewrite in terms of these H functions. So again, since this is just a sum of commutators that fan out to a sum of products of the Hamiltonian densities, each of which annihilates the chiral primary, we can just show that U again acts like this projection operator. It projects only onto the J equals 0 state, and so then you get the 0 for the whole thing, since H of 0 is equal to 0. So these are rather complicated calculations, but it's all fairly straightforward once you get the hang of what the definitions are. All right, so the last slide I wanted to put on here is just, what about if you go beyond one loop corrections? Now, people have talked about higher loop corrections. People have worked out answers for higher loop corrections in certain subsectors. It looks like there's some integrable structure there. It also looked like there was some discrepancies at three loops if you looked at certain BMN operators. On the dual strings theory side, they were called spinning string states, folded string states. The subject is still somewhat up in the air as far as higher loops is concerned, whether it is integrable or not. So all I want to do here is say two things. One is that, the first is that the conjecture in our first paper was that not only do we have this Yangian structure, which we've written the representations for, JA and QA, but we conjecture that that Yangian structure will survive to all loops in the Yang-Mills coupling constant. And then we began to check that order by order and got various relations. This was one of the relations that we got, which followed from this assumption that these would be the all-order commutation relations. So in a sense, if you impose the Yangian symmetry to all orders, that's a form of higher loop integrability. You can make discussions of that, which we did in some of the sections of the paper. But now the last thing I want to say, because the hour is getting late, is that you can do one other thing, which is I found rather heartening, is that if you define how do we define these exact Yangian generators? Well, there are these terms, these tree-level terms, and they have one loop corrections, two loop corrections, etc. So in particular, if you look at one of the ordinary symmetry generators, when that's equal to the dilatation generator, that's the exact dilatation operator we're talking about. That's equal to the bare dilatation plus an anomalous dilatation, anomalous dimension. So far we were just talking about this at the one loop level, but you could think of this as everything, one loop, two loop, three loop. And now if you look at the commutation relations, this one, J with Q, if you let JA be the dilatation, then the structure constant just becomes the conformal spin of the object. So this relation for A equal to the dilatation becomes this relation. If you look at what the bare generator on the exact Yangian generator looks like, it again will just be the bare conformal dimension. This is the statement that higher orders of perturbation theory don't mix conformal dimensions. And so if you take these two commutation relations and you subtract them, then d tilde minus d is delta d. That's the anomalous dimension to all orders in g squared n. And the commutator of that with qd is 0. So here it's found that one of the Casimirs of the exact Yangian is delta d. Now, I think that's good news. That means that the exact Hamiltonian not the whole exact Hamiltonian, because d tilde, after all, is a Yangian generator. It's not going to be anything with q. It's not going to have q. What? This is facts, and this is this is result from these two equations. You subtract these two equations, you get this equation. This is if you impose this symmetry, then this happens. If you impose that conjecture, then this happens. So, and also the same is true for the ordinary symmetry generator. So that means that, you see, the question I asked when people originally started to think about integrable systems was, well, okay, this whole thing works at one loop, but what makes you think that the higher loop contributions to the dilatation operator will also be a family of an integrable Hamiltonian? I mean, there will be higher loop contributions to the dilatation operator because you get Feynman graphs so you can calculate them. And even if there was an integrable structure in the theory, what would make you think that the dilatation higher loop contributions were the thing that was going to be that Hamiltonian at higher loops? And so this is really the understanding of why the higher loop Hamiltonian, at least the anomalous dimension part of the higher loop Hamiltonian, will be a Casimir union. Okay, thanks. You've taken the large n limit.
No.
That's what's happened. Yes. You can write these Yangian. Well, you can write down if you look at the if you write down the I have a slide for that if you want to see it. I don't understand. You can write down what the Noether current is. So here it's page 21. So you do see it already in the classical system. The problem is you don't know how to go up to one loop from this. So here's the classical Yang-Mills theory. And here is the, you don't know it's integrable or not. You know the self-dual equations are integrable, and you don't know about the full theory. Now, what's being said here is that if you look at the Noether current, don't do PSU224, but just do SO2,4, the subgroup. Then you can write down what the Noether current is in terms of the, here's the energy momentum tensor in the classical theory. And you can write down what the Noether current is, if these are the conformal killing vectors, and you form that product of things, and that will be the Noether current that's conserved for any g squared n. That's the standard law for ordinary symmetries in Yang-Mills. Now, if you set g squared n equal to 0, so just work at 0 coupling, because after all, the formulas that we gave so far were just tree-level couplings, then you can also form an untraced matrix. You don't take the, this is, remember, this theta mu nu is the trace of this. So if you look at this untraced matrix, then it will turn out that that combination is also conserved, as long as you're at g squared n equal to 0. And then if you take, since that's conserved, you can take products of those things. And so that's beginning to look like, that's the first one, this is the second charge, and if you had three things, that would be the third charge. Now, right, it's the planar limit that really is what's doing it. What? Well, we have some expressions for the ordinary symmetry generator in the quantum case. What hasn't been understood is how to write down expressions for the Yangian generators in the quantum case, but we have equations that constrict what they have to be, namely those conjectured commutation relations to all orders in the coupling constant. So probably the n equal 4 theory, this of course is the superconformal version of it, and it relies heavily on the properties of the mechanics. The technical aspects of it rely on the dilatation properties of the dilatation operator. Right, but what is being suggested here is that probably ordinary Yangnils at large M will be in. Any other questions? I know it's late. I'm sorry the hour is so late. We'll try to get an earlier room the next time. It just was a lot of variables this time. Thanks for coming.